Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. We're here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. My name is Allison Rose Levy. I'm an environmental, food, and health journalist and advocate, reporting here on Connect the Dots, as well as on Alternet and the Huffington Post, where you can find my blogs on a range of issues that affect our personal health and our total health environment. Every week on Connect the Dots, I interview different experts, advocates, thought leaders, scientists, authors, and others who bring unique insight to bear on different facets of all that connects our personal health to our collective health. And each week on the show, we look at different aspects of that. We're coming on about the third year of this program on Progressive Radio, just around this time of year. So happy anniversary to Connect the Dots. Please do take a look in our archives, because we have a wonderful collection of in-depth conversations with a lot of fascinating people. Last week we had Anthony Ingraffia talking about fracking in New York State, and we've covered that issue a lot. We also had Larry Dossey on the show, Gabor Mate on the show, and a whole host of interesting, insightful folks. And today our guest is someone that I have long wanted to have on Connect the Dots, and I'm so happy that she can be with us here today, because she is going to connect the dots between something very, very important, which is the connection between shale gas and the shale gas boom and our health. I've reported on the attempts to frack in the Northeast since about 2009. And as a health journalist, you know, we have a lot of dots that haven't been connected when lawmakers and elected officials and regulators go forth with lax regulations or green stamps, rubber stamps to industry for complex industrial processes involving a wide array of problematic and hazardous chemicals that can impact health. So on today's show, Wilma Subra will be here to really connect those health dots for us, and I'm so excited to have her. She is the winner of a MacArthur Fellowship Genius Award. She's a microbiologist and chemist, and for several decades she's really been tracking all of these effects. She recently completed a 7-year term as vice chair of the Environmental Protection Agency's National Advisory Council for Environmental Policy and Technology. She has also served on the EPA National Environmental Justice Advisory Council and a whole host of other organizations. And from all of her work, she really has compiled a broad understanding through different industrial activities, the kinds of impacts on human health that have been left outside the pale and uncharted when we proceed with these activities without proper precaution, regulation, and scientific study. So we're going to talk about that all throughout this hour. I'm so thrilled. Welcome to Connect the Dots, Wilma Subra.
Thank you. Thank you for the invitation.
You know, one of the things that really that's really up in the news as we are recording this program today here in January 2014 is there recently has been a chemical spill into a river in West Virginia and affecting the water supply of 300,000 people. And one of the things that really struck me about that was an article in the Washington Post, which was picked up by mainstream media, basically saying, what? We don't know what this chemical in the water is. We don't know what the health impact is. People are reporting certain things, but, you know, we can't go anywhere and find data on this. They're kind of shocked. I've covered the attempts to regulate toxic chemicals against the powerful push of the American Chemistry Council for a number of years, but most of the general public just of course those attempts have failed thanks to industry pressure thus far. So more people need to be involved, but what the average citizen is kind of shocked and surprised to discover that there's a gap in the scientific and regulatory understanding. Can you give a little bit of your understanding and context for that?
Sure. Well, there's a huge number of chemicals that are in the marketplace used on a daily basis, not only in home products or things that you would buy and bring into your home, but in the industrial facilities as well. And the majority of these chemicals have not been tested to determine what kind of health impacts they have, mm-hmm. nor what kind of impacts they have on the environment as well. So when an event occurs, like occurred recently in West Virginia, you start looking to see, well, what do we know about that chemical? We know the name of the chemical, but do we know the health impacts? Do we know how toxic it is? Do we know how long it's going to persist in the environment? How far downstream it's going to go as a plume? And for the most part, that information was severely lacking. And even when you were able to look at the company, Eastman, that actually manufactured it, it still had a lot of proprietary requirements on it so that you couldn't get to that information. So I think this was an example where people really understood what we don't know about a large number of these chemicals that we need to know right away when there's an event such as this spill into the river, which serves as a drinking water source for over 300,000 people.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, this isn't a surprise to you. You've been observing different populations at different times impacted by different sudden crises like this one, suddenly kind of going, oh my gosh, what happened here? What are the effects we're seeing? What do we know about this? Can you take our listeners and me on a little bit of a history through your experience in encountering this in different crises and in different communities? Give us a little background on your work with that.
Well, one of the events was Hurricane Katrina.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a little different, but it brings in the same issues. Mm-hmm. When the storm surge moved onshore along the shores of Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, and the panhandle of Florida, it brought with it all the sediment sludge that was in the water bottoms. And these sediments in the water bottoms were contaminated over generations, where people used to just dump everything they didn't want into the water and think it went away.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the storm surge brought it all and laid it on the land. So immediately I was in the field taking samples of this and analyzing it and saying, we really need to address this situation. So I had the analysis, I had the chemical components, and I had the biological components and the microbiological components. And yet all of the agencies were going like, but if we touch any of this, if we pick it up and dispose of it, then we are going to be liable to dispose of it all. And in some cases it was 10 to 15 feet thick. In other cases it was like 6 inches thick. And so the knowledge that I had developed, the agencies didn't want to address.
Mm-hmm.
The second example is the BP explosion and fire that occurred in 2010.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, it became a slick on the Gulf of Mexico. As a result of that, we had a large, difficult time finding out the components of that crude. And as that slick moved further and further, it was dispersed into the air as an aerosol, and it came on shore all along the coast as an aerosol, sort of like a pump hairspray, and
mm-hmm.
people inhaled and ingested it and became very sick. But once again, we didn't have the information on the chemical that were in the crude itself. And then they started spraying the crude with dispersant, hoping to sink it, and so that you didn't see the slick, and the slick didn't move on shore. And that was one of the issues, is that the dispersant, everything was proprietary. So we couldn't get the chemical components of it, and we couldn't get the health impacts associated with the dispersant. So it took us about 3 weeks to be able to get that information, sort of about the same time frame as it's taken to get the detailed information in West Virginia. And that is inappropriate. We need to have access to that information right away because people are being made very, very ill, and we need to know what the chemicals are, what the health impacts are, and how to treat those people.
So the status quo that you're describing is that the material has not been studied, and in fact the information is proprietary, so to protect a corporate trade secret, so that if there is laxity, if there is are acts of nature, if there are, you know, the inevitable problems, human error, anything else that creates these, and we've had repeated incidents of all different kinds, then we are basically not prepared to address the health symptoms that people are experiencing. Are we better able to address what the long range health impacts may be?
We're still missing that kind of information. So frequently the information is not there. And in addition to that, the companies often have the details of the chemical compositions, but they call it proprietary, so they are not obliged to provide that to the local governments, to the federal governments, to the emergency responders, as well as to the people that are being exposed.
Do you think most members of the general public, whether they are suddenly in a crisis situation because of one of these accidents or situations, or in general, until, you know, the kind of hasn't happened in their community yet or manifested in a form that it draws to their attention, do you think most people really understand the tremendous gap here and the implications of it?
I don't think they really understand the large vacuum, and until it becomes a personal issue, mm-hmm. there's not that much interest in knowing that. But then when you are impacted, it becomes very personal, and you want that information, and you want it to be available right now.
Mm-hmm. So you have actually worked with people and communities that are going through that kind of wake-up call experience. Before we sort of, I mean, we can along the way discuss the science a bit, but can you tell me a little bit the kinds of symptoms that show up, as well as how people respond when they begin appearing, and, you know, what they feel when they, you know, as this evolves and they realize the lack of information and their health symptoms to themselves or families are there. Can you draw our listeners a little bit of a picture of that?
Well, usually I get a phone call from someone who is having health problems, and their request is, please come to our community and tell us what is going on that is making us sick.
Mm-hmm.
So you look at various sources of data. You look at what kind of facilities may be in their community, industrial facilities or wastewater treatment plants or maybe agricultural processing chemical plants, and determine what kind of information is available on those facilities and what kind of emissions and releases are occurring from those facilities, and put together a background document of, these are the chemicals that are potentially in your community and these are the associated health impacts. And frequently people will sit there when you do a workshop for the community, and when they walked in they thought, oh, well, you know, this doesn't impact me. And then as you go through the information and start presenting, these are the chemicals and these are the health impacts, they go, like, those are the health impacts I have, and I didn't realize it was perhaps coming from chemical exposure.
Mm-hmm. What would be an example of, you know, typical symptoms that might initially present?
Well, usually it's the acute symptoms, symptoms that you develop after a very short exposure. It can be burning eyes, irritated nose, throat, and lungs, respiratory problems, and then it starts getting worse over time, and then you become engaged in cardiovascular impacts, decreased lung function. Then in the long term, it can be like liver and kidney damage or cancer, blood cancers such as leukemia, if it's benzene, If it's vinyl chloride, that one causes angiosarcoma of the liver and brain cancer. And for the most part, the people aren't aware of what chemicals are in their community, mm-hmm. in their environment. And once you start presenting it, they realize that they're having some of those symptoms. And then you start doing what I call an odor and symptom log, where you provide them one page front and back, where if they smell something and they have a health impact, they record it and mm-hmm. list what the odors smell like and what the health symptoms are, and then go to their TV and get the wind speed and direction. So then you can start figuring out which direction the odor came from, so perhaps a facility caused those health symptoms, and you look at the facility's records for that day and see whether or not they had an accidental release or an upset of some sort that could have released chemicals that made it to the people and exposed the people.
So you say that the actual data about industrial releases is available, but it sounds like from what you're saying, correct me if I'm wrong, that you're saying it's more available than the actual information about those chemicals. So, so in other words, people wouldn't ever question or even maybe in many cases know what they are downwind or downwater from, or, you know, what they might be exposed to. It might not be so obvious, but those companies are actually required to share that information?
The answer to that is yes and no. If you're a large industrial facility and you have a release, you have mm-hmm. to report it. You have to report it by telephone or by email to both the federal government as well as to the local government, the emergency response or 9/11 issues. And then at that time, you have to report what chemicals you think you released, and then you have to follow up with a written report in 5 to 7 days where you estimate how much of the chemical was being released. However, they frequently just record and report a couple of the chemicals, not everything. But mm-hmm. when you look at the oil and gas drilling and production and processing facilities, mm-hmm. Compressor stations and centralized facilities, they are not required to report those kind of releases. So there is a division of large industries have to report. These smaller ones that are frequently very dispersed in the communities and very close to the communities do not have to report.
So you're saying that the pipelines and other, because we're sort of segueing now to gas infrastructures, you're saying that they, because of size, do not have the same reporting requirements, or is it because we've seen, for example, as per the Halliburton loophole, which exempts gas activities from a great number of EPA measures and requirements that other industries are subjected to. Is this because of similar loopholes, or is it just due to size that they are not required to report?
It's the industry category, and the drilling and production and processing do not have to report. And
that's,
if you have an event and you go to that facility and, you know, go to the gate and try and talk to someone, frequently, there is no one there. A lot of times, they're not manned. Or if they are there, they say, we don't have to tell you what we released or whether we had an event or not. Meanwhile, the people downwind are very, very sick and are trying to figure out, should they leave the area to reduce their exposure, and how long is this event going to go on for?
So it sounds like what you're indicating is that, in fact, it is a part of the, you know, related to the Halliburton loophole, which provided this kind of industry-wide exemption. So that is, I think we, you know, when people initially were concerned about fracking, you know, gas drilling specifically in their areas and the use of toxic chemicals and how those might migrate, that was kind of regional or area specific. And we kind of had trouble identifying what those chemicals were. Theo Colburn did some work on that because of these exemptions and because of the corporate secrecy. But what you're now pointing out is that that same pattern of exemption is following all of the infrastructures, and these are not confined merely to an area where drilling activity is occurring. Because this gas, the purpose of producing it is therefore to transport it and disseminate it. The kinds of pipeline and other infrastructural activities, those could be anywhere precisely because they're carrying the gas to end users of various kinds. So tell our listeners a bit more about, so this is a much wider population that could be exposed as a result. Is that so?
Correct, yes. Mm-hmm. And it falls in the category that oil and gas, the regulation of oil and gas, is designated specifically to the states, and it's prohibited from being regulated at the federal level. And therefore, these types of facilities aren't required to report their emissions. They're not required to report their emissions that are occurring on an ongoing basis, other than if they have a minor source permit and they have to report that once a year, and then they aren't required to report it when they have an accident or an upset or an event.
So it's theoretically possible that individual states or localities or do they have the opportunity to regulate or to require reporting, or is that kind of taken off the plate because the federal level has allowed these exemptions?
It's taken off the plate at the local level. Mm-hmm. The issues that the local governments have the authority is to do siting where these kind of facilities could be located. Mm-hmm. And in most cases, the local government doesn't have siting regulations, but they can have siting regulations and enforce them, or the industry is under the jurisdiction of the state agency for permits and operational conditions and all of those issues.
Mm-hmm. And for example, in New York State, that is in New York State specifically where I'm reporting from here, would that specifically, is a state agency that is really very close ties to industry, where their mandate is really to help and encourage industry and not to protect public health. That could be different in different states, but that is the case in terms of how the regulators are organized in New York State, for example.
Right, and a good example of that is there's a compressor station that announced to the community, because it was required in their permit, that they had to notify the community prior to having a blowdown event. The blowdown event occurred over about 12 hours, but they were not required to report what quantity of chemicals they released during those 12 hours. Whereas if you have a blowdown event at a chemical plant or a refinery, you have to report specifically what you released, what quantities you released, and what chemicals were in the release. So that's where the community is left not having the information they need to deal with the situation.
They don't know whether to evacuate. They don't know whether later health problems could be attributable to this or how these might be treated. Let's just, before we kind of go further in depth about the kinds of exposures and health problems that are likely occasioned by this gas infrastructural activity, let's just step over and ask one question before we go there to, if we had more information, is that helpful to healthcare professionals in treating or mitigating risks of illness from this, or are we also in a gray area when it comes to healthcare treatment or practice as to, what we could do about that?
Well, the healthcare providers need that kind of information about what chemicals the patient was exposed to in order to determine the health symptoms associated with that exposure or not mm-hmm. associated with that exposure, and how mm-hmm. to treat them. So mm-hmm. in cases, particularly in emergency rooms, when people come in and they've been impacted by mm-hmm. a release from a facility, that health care provider needs that information right away. But that information is not available. And in some states, they have to actually sign an agreement that if they are provided that information, they can't even release it to the victim that they're treating. But then on the overall scale, as we see from the BP spill, frequently the medical profession is reluctant to make those connections. Mm-hmm. You come into the doctor's office, they will treat you, they will say, oh, you have a respiratory infection, here's some antibiotics. But when you say, well, I was exposed to the BP crude oil, or I was exposed to this release from this facility, that's mm-hmm. when they start going like, I can't make that connection. I can just treat the symptoms that you walk in here with. Mm-hmm. And so other than going to a large medical school where there are practitioners there, on the general practitioner at the local level, there's a very reluctance to make those connections. And so this really frustrates the people, particularly when events keep occurring over and over again that they are exposed to, and they're looking for someone to help them deal with the situation, but to say, you know, you should or should not continue to live there, you should distance yourself, or when you smell something, you should get out of the area. A few doctors have done that for their patients, but not that many.
Mm-hmm. I guess, well, here's another question I have. You know, what you're saying, the advice is, get out of the area. Is there any other specific treatment that people, the doctors even have beyond get out of the area?
Well, just on the get out of the area, you want to be sure you're not exposed as you're trying to get out.
Mm-hmm.
If it's a very, very toxic chemical, sometimes the emergency response will issue a shelter in place where you close your windows, close your doors, turn off your air conditioning or heating system so that mm-hmm. you're not bringing in outside air, so that you don't go out and get exposed. So
mm-hmm.
you have to consider that as well.
Mm-hmm.
But the medical profession does have treatments if they know the chemicals they're dealing with.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well,
and
that's
I
good
do
news.
Frequent mm-hmm. workshops at medical clinics mm-hmm. explaining in their particular community what the facilities are, what the chemicals are that are being released, and what kind of health impacts, and trying to get the practitioners to understand, like, if this morning you had 5 cases of bloody nose come in,
mm-hmm.
you need to start asking the question, did something occur that is resulting in these medical conditions, so that they are the ones that can put together the cause and effect.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They should be the ones that could call their emergency response office and say, we're seeing this situation. Did you have anyone report an event to you?
Mm-hmm.
And then that would give them additional information to treat the patients.
Mm-hmm. And how do they treat patients for this kind of exposure?
They treat the symptoms.
They treat the symptoms.
But if they know the chemicals and they have time to look up those chemicals and get the health impacts, then that will help them understand what the patient is experiencing and treat them more appropriately.
Okay, I get that. That makes a lot of sense. We are going to take our station identification break here, which we take for a few minutes at this portion of Connect the Dots. And when we come back, I'm in conversation today on Connect the Dots with Wilma Subra, and we're talking about health impacts from toxic chemical exposures due to principally energy technologies on today's Connect the Dots. When we return, we're going to talk more specifically about pipelines and compressor stations and the nationwide risk caused at risk to expanded populations due to these pipelines and infrastructures being built out in the United States to carry fracked gas to its end users. So please stay with us on Connect the Dots at the break, and we'll be right back. Welcome back, listeners, to the second half of Connect the Dots. Today we're talking with Wilma Subra about the health impacts of gas shale fracking, dissemination, and infrastructures, as well as other contaminations and industrial health exposures that are impacting populations across the United States. If you missed the first half of the show, please check out the Connect the Dots archive on the PRN website, and make sure to like our show on iTunes, as well as pass it along to your other friends and colleagues. I'm here with Wilma Subra, a leading and advanced pioneer in looking at population-wide health impacts of industrial activities, specifically energy-related. In the first half of the show, for those who are just tuning in, we kind of did an overview of her fascinating background and the range of issues. In the second half, we're going to hone in a little bit more on gas pipelines and compressor stations, which are now moving across the country to bring gas to its end users. What are you seeing, Wilma Subra, in terms of the health and environmental impacts of these infrastructures?
Well, first of all, you have to consider what chemicals are being released by the pipelines, the compressor stations, the metering stations, and the regulating stations. And they consist of the natural gas components, the methane, the ethane, the butane, and the propane. But in addition to the majority of those chemicals moving through the pipelines and the compressor stations and metering stations, you also have the very toxic chemicals such as benzene, which is a known human cancer-causing agent, causes leukemia. You have toluene, ethylbenzene, xylene, butadiene, carbon disulfide, and carbonyl sulfide, and those are the things that give off what we describe as a rotten egg odor, and they are very, very toxic. And when I do presentations, I usually list the toxic impacts of the rotten egg chemical, and then someone always in the audience says, yeah, but you left out the major one, death. Because if you get in an area where there's a concentration of these sulfur compounds, they can overwhelm the body and actually kill you. So it's critical that you be in an area where there's a lot of circulation. And in addition, there's compounds like chlorobenzene, diethylbenzene, and then formaldehyde, which is also a known human cancer-causing agent, and naphthalene, which is a polynuclear aromatic hydrocarbon, which is very persistent in the environment, meaning it lasts a very long time. And there are another whole host of chemicals. So when you have a release from a pipeline or from a compressor station or a metering station, these are the chemicals that are released into the environment.
Mm. And are these coming from the fracked gas itself? You know, where? How do these chemicals get into the methane that's there?
They are part of the natural gas itself. It came from the formations that produce them, and then that natural gas is processed, sweetened, meaning it removes a lot of the sulfur components, dried, meaning it removes the moisture content, and then it's distributed in the pipelines to end users and also to utility companies that provide it to homes and businesses.
Wow, that's really, there's also the methane itself is also a major contributor to climate change, as we've now discovered. But what you're mentioning here is the impacts in the local area. So, for example, if there's a pipeline going through your area, does that mean that at all along the way, at any point where a pipeline travels, there can be this kind of evaporation or release from it?
Usually it's occurring at a metering station or a regulating station or at the compressor locations. However, if you have small leaks, it can occur along the regular portion of the pipeline. In Louisiana, we farm sugar cane, and when we harvest, we actually burn the stalks to get rid of the leaves in the field. And we have a lot of natural gas pipelines in our area. And the way the companies find out that there are leaks is when you come back the next day and there are still burning areas in a field. And you look, and sure enough, those burning areas are where a pipeline is leaking.
So, in other words, how many, I mean, has anyone mapped the area and therefore the number of people that could potentially be exposed to this, or is that yet to occur?
Well, the mapping of pipelines is an interesting situation because in a lot of areas, those pipelines were put down in the 20s and 30s, and there was little to no record of where they were located. More recent pipelines have to submit maps of exactly where they are. So that's when you see these locations where it's still burning the next morning. It wasn't even recorded on any type of map. And then now that we have the big issue of 9/11 and terrorists, the pipeline companies are very reluctant to show you people where they are actually located. So if you're not in an area when they actually lay the pipeline, you frequently don't know where they are because that information becomes confidential.
My goodness. So people could be exposed and not have any clue that a pipeline is even in their area.
Yes, yes.
Wow, that's really surprising. And what about the compressor stations? A compressor station, basically, a pipeline of with the flowing gas has to have a compressor station at every, you know, certain interval, or the gas will not flow through that pipeline. And the point of the compressor station at each certain interval is to keep the gas flowing. So these are less, they're not at every inch of pipeline, they're less common. Are they also a higher exposure problem for those that live near them?
Yes. So when you have compressor stations, as you said, they're there to push the gas through the pipeline. And at some of the compressor stations, they even have drying units and sweetening units. So what happens is at compressor stations, when the compressors operate, they have emissions going on all the time. And if they have what are called stacks or vents, you will see those emissions, particularly if you look with an infrared camera, you'll see it just billowing out. And based on all the work I've done in communities around the United States, 90% of the individuals that live and work within 2 to 3 miles of a compressor station report experiencing odor events and health impacts. So it's quite prevalent around compressor stations. And the chemicals that I listed just a few minutes ago are the kinds of chemicals that are released by the compressor stations because they are handling the natural gas that's moving through the pipelines.
So is there a so it's kind of a more intensive exposure, it sounds like, that is occurring at the sites of the compressor stations. Would that be correct?
Yes, it's more of a point source as opposed to somewhere along the pipeline itself.
Do you have any rough guesstimates of how many Americans would be within the parameter that you're describing to be exposed to these chemicals, you know, via compressor stations?
I haven't done those kind of calculations, but because of the shale gas that's being produced in so many areas, there's a need for additional pipelines with compressor stations. So the number of pipelines and compressor stations, or what's referred to as infrastructure, is increasing every day. So there's a much larger population being and potentially to be exposed as these infrastructures go in.
So the short-term health impacts are the kinds of symptoms that you described. The long-range ones are also the similar ones that you've been describing all along in terms of leukemia and various cancers, other kinds of things. Is that correct? Liver damage. Are there additional ones?
Absolutely. The short-term ones are like irritation to the skin, eyes, nose, throat, and lungs, respiratory and sinus problems, headaches, dizziness, nausea, vomiting, skin rashes. And then the long ones are personality changes, depression, anxiety, irritability, confusion, drowsiness, and weakness, and irregular heartbeat. And a lot of those depression and irritability are not recognized as being associated with exposure to the chemicals from a compressor station. And until you go into a community and start laying it out, then people start realizing, well, I didn't have that until the compressor station came into our community, and after it operated for a little while, those are the things that I started developing. And those are the things that are difficult for people to also admit.
Well, you know, it actually seems like what we in the healthcare field would call, you know, a multifactorial stressor, because on the one hand, you have the actual biochemical, physiological exposure that you're describing and have been describing throughout this program. And on the other hand, for those who I'm acquainted with the community at Minisink, which is, you know, fought hard against a major compressor station in an area about an hour or so north of New York City. But in those communities where they fight and encounter a kind of disinterested government or regulators who are really just promoting industry needs and rubber stamping rather than public health, there's also a disillusionment, feelings of despair and powerlessness that could also be contributing factors to depression that set in as a result of the larger social context and ramifications of these kinds of decisions. So that's what we would call almost multifactorial, and yet people would probably point to the one or the other, and in some cases, outsiders who are not yet subject to that in their communities could say something like, oh, well, they just got crabby because they became activists and they can't be all that bad, where, in fact, there could be, you know, both these psychosocial as well as these very real, that you're describing, physiological impacts.
Yeah, in addition to that, when you look at the other chronic health impacts, you have, like, damage to the liver and kidneys and lungs, the cardiovascular system, and damage to the nervous system and the brain. But when you come down with one of those conditions and you go to the doctor, the doctor's not going to ask you, well, what do you live by? What are you being exposed? He might ask you, what's your occupation, and do you have an occupational exposure? But he's not going to ask you what's in your community, and he's not going to try and connect what he's seeing in front of him with an exposure that has occurred over the long term.
So, in effect, it becomes these long-term impacts could be being incurred right now with long-range health costs, both personal and economic, to the individual and to the society, being incurred and increased without knowledge of it or really a good way to track it. Is that so, would you say?
Yes.
And what can people do about this? I mean, what do you view as being, I know you're a scientist, but what do you think people can and should be doing, whether they're in the region or in other regions that this could one day come to? Do you have any, you know, kind of suggestions along those lines?
Well, they need to understand the chemicals that are being released. They need to understand the health impacts associated with those chemicals. And then they need to understand, like, compressor stations have blowdown events. And if you are notified in advance, it's better to get out of the area before the event occurs so you're not exposed. So you need them to understand enough to try and reduce their exposure, but also when they come down with any of these conditions, be able to go to a doctor that can really address the situation as to its cause.
And so what kind of symptom relief are doctors able to provide?
Well, it depends. If it's respiratory, they can give you an antibiotic. And as soon as you finish the antibiotic and another release occurs, you just redevelop that same situation. So after he's seen you two or three times with the same condition, then he's got to be thinking, well, you're exposed to something. It's not like you have a baby that goes to nursery and comes home with everything that all the other children have. this is something that you're being exposed to and it's causing these kind of impacts. Mm-hmm. And then hopefully he would send you to a specialist.
So since the time that you began reporting on this, and I want to send people also to your website for more information if, you know, they belong or know people who belong to these kinds of communities, are you seeing an increase in these kinds of general population exposures in terms of numbers of people? You know, what is looking different now to the way things look, let's say, 10 years ago or 20 years ago?
Well, what we're having in recent years is this development of shale, both oil and gas. And as a result of that development, they're drilling and fracking wells and putting in processing facilities, putting in pipelines, and then putting in the very large pipelines to transmit the oil and gas long distances. And so there's a much larger population being exposed to all of these types of situations than there were 5 or 6 years ago. And in addition, you have the workers that are putting in all of these units, and they are being exposed as well. But frequently they come in, they do a job, and then they leave. So they are harder to keep up with as being impacted at a specific location. But the workers will tell you off the record that they're having these same type of health impacts. But if they speak up, they will be let go, and they desperately need a job and that income. So they're reluctant to speak out.
With your work with the Environmental Protection Agency, what were you? What do you advise them? What kind of conversations are highest-level regulators having, either publicly or behind the scenes, about this situation and their ability and their to regulate this, given the Halliburton loophole and these other these kind of loopholes to normal environmental regulation? What do the folks at the EPA? How do they view this?
Well, based on all the work I've done in the field, and when I deal with EPA and serve on their advisory committees, I bring the message from the impacted communities. So I lay out this is what we found, this is what's being released, we've got that documented. These are the health impacts associated with those chemicals, and then these are the health impacts that the citizens are having. And also, this is what the conditions are like out in the field. How many flaring events are going on? How many flares that aren't even burning that the emissions are coming out of? How many vent stacks out of condensate tanks and crude oil storage tanks are releasing these huge quantities of chemicals? Showing them that these are the routes of exposure, and these are the impacts of that route of exposure, and the need to be able to decrease that exposure by regulating the process.
And are they finding, I mean, you're doing an enormous public service through taking that message and doing that data collection and connecting those dots on behalf of the affected communities. And, you know, with this kind of unmitigated industry invasion in a certain kind of way without proper protections. Is that message being carried home at the EPA, or are they hamstrung themselves in their ability to take this on, as one would imagine it was their function and wish to do?
Well, I think the answer to that is both at the federal level with the EPA as well as the state level. The message is getting through to them clearly, but because of the political situation, it's very difficult for them to change regulations and to do more enforcement, because when they start doing more enforcement, particularly at the state level, those enforcement individuals will suddenly find that their line item vetoed right out of the budgets if they're doing a good job. And then when you try and get stricter regs on the books, again, the oil and gas lobbyists is there in large quantities to ensure that that doesn't occur. So the message is getting through to them, but their ability to do something about that message is being decreased by the power of the industry that is dominating what's going on in all of these communities.
So we're really voting, so to speak, or enabling a political structure that is undermining health. Is this, you know, I think what happens is that before a crisis situation occurs in a given area, the human tendency is to go on with life as usual and believe that, you know, it's going to happen somewhere else, will not be affected. What you're describing is a situation where more and more people will actually be affected and be at risk. Do you know, is it, do you see it really becoming a very, very widespread problem for more and more Americans?
I do see it being a very widespread problem. And one of the issues is that there's a real need for baseline testing before shale comes, the shale development comes into your area, where you test the water, the groundwater, the soil, and the air, as well as do health surveys of what kind of conditions exist before it comes in. And then you're able to compare that to how the situation degrades over time.
You know, this is the kind of thing that it would be part of the monitoring job of government to do, but what I hear you saying, what I'm aware is happening, is that ordinary citizens have to kind of take this in hand for themselves and make that happen, as strange as that sounds, in order to have those baselines and create a compelling case to the government for taking this in hand. Well, that is really quite the state of affairs. I want to point listeners, before we say goodbye to today's program, to your website, leanweb.org, http://leanweb.org. You can learn more about Wilma Suber's terrific environmental work and read all of her posts and about her current activities. I want to thank you so much for being with me today on Connect the Dots. Your work is just invaluable.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Thank you so much, and maybe we'll have you back as things develop. You know, this is so important for people to understand. And I want to thank you as well, listeners, for joining us on today's program. Please check out leanweb.org. You can also sign up at my eZine site for show announcements, healthjournalist.com. Please come back next week and be with us again on Connect the Dots every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and hoping you a happy, healthy next week.
Mm-hmm.